Welcome to Eerie Essex. I'm Bethan Briggs Miller.
And I'm Ailsa Clark.
Thank you for joining us on our journey into the stranger side of the county.
We will be exploring the folklore, urban legends, and supernatural encounters that form part of its rich history.
Well, welcome to episode 14 of Eerie Essex. It's been a while, and I'm sure, I hope you've missed us. We've missed you. We've missed telling these stories, but we're back with a particularly gruesome filled and eerie set of tales because this month we are looking at poltergeists. Ooh. And thank you. And thank you to everyone who helped us choose the title of this episode, which is, and we've had to look this up because we keep arguing about the amount of booms. Boom, shake the room.
Yeah.
There's actually an astonishing amount of songs from the 90s that have boom in the title.
We got so confused. Well, I got so confused when I was putting that poll up because we couldn't remember which song we'd actually agreed on.
Yeah, because it's the Venga Boys with boom, 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 boom. And what was the other one?
Oh, it was the boom, boom, boom.
And let me hear you say anyway.
And then I accidentally landed on the Will Smith, Jazzy Jeff, boom, shake the room. Yeah.
So we hope, thank you again for the poll and everybody who voted. And this month, Ailsa's going first. So Ailsa, take it away.
Right. I have a particularly grim story.
Yes.
Around the time of the First World War, there was a family in rural Clavering suffering from a very noisy poltergeist. Loud bangs in a deserted room, which was used for tool storage, kept them up all night. And they said it sounded as though heavy equipment was being thrown across the room. But when they would go and check the next morning, there was no evidence that any of these tools had been moved. Their cows were also scared half to death when they were calving by the sounds of loud bangs coming from the empty side of the barn. There were other strange incidents as well. Often in the middle of the night, they would hear the sound of the front door opening and closing again and again and again, even though they were sure that they had locked the door. There were also claims as far back as 1905, when the house stood empty, of the sound of somebody playing piano. This might sound like a run-of-the-mill typical poltergeist activity. But there's one very important fact about this case. These incidents took place at the scene of a famous murder case, Moat Farm.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So to go back to the beginning, in 1898, Camille Holland was living in Elgin Crescent, London. She was by and large an independent woman. At the age of 56, she was still single and managed her own affairs, taking care of her stocks and shares, which were valued around £6,000. I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot today, but at the time she was very well to do.
Yeah.
And she kind of sounds like a cool lady, to be honest. She was Yeah, she was great. She was a music teacher. She seemed to have traveled a fair bit. She saved money by mending her own clothes. And what she saved, she invested in the stocks and shares, which made her independently wealthy. So she hadn't inherited that wealth necessarily. She'd made it on her own.
Good for her.
In the autumn of 1898, she seemed to have tired of the single life and decided to advertise for a potential husband, which was apparently something you could do back then. And unfortunately, she had the luck of meeting Samuel Dougal that year. They began a relationship and Camille soon purchased Coldham Farm, which they renamed Moat Farm. It stood in the little village of Clavering, not far from Saffron Walden. Perhaps Camille already sensed that Dougal was not all he claimed to be, as she insisted in putting the deed to the farm in her name only. After some renovations to the farmhouse, they moved into their new home as man and wife in name only, as they were not legally married. This was due to Dougal having not yet divorced his previous wife, though according to him, they had been separated for many years. They were also joined by Camille's little dog, Jacko, and their newly appointed maid, Florence. Poor Florence had barely set foot in the house when she discovered that she was the object of Samuel's attentions. On the 14th of May, Samuel made inappropriate advances to her in the kitchen, and on the night of the 16th, he tried to enter her room. Florence resisted his advances on both occasions, and in the latter instance, she held the door shut and screamed to alert Camille. When Camille arrived on the scene, she sent Samuel off to bed and she slept in the same room as Florence for the rest of that night and on the following two nights. So by the time of May 19th, Florence found herself alone in the house with Samuel. Earlier that evening at 6:30, Samuel and Camille had gone out on a pony and trap, and at 8:30, Samuel had returned without Camille. And when Florence asked after Camille, he told her that she had gone to London and would return later that night. When Florence came down to start her chores at 7 a.m. the next day, she was surprised to find Samuel already up, dressed and eating breakfast. He told her that he had received a letter from Camille in which he said she had gone on holiday, yachting of all things.
Mm.
And this turns out it was of little consequence to Florence, who'd already made up her mind to leave the house, and her mother was on her way to collect her that morning. So she left with her wages and didn't think any more about it. Samuel was not on his own for long. He employed a new maid, Emma Burgess, and was soon joined by another Mrs. Dougal, who was in fact his third wife, the one he had apparently separated from for years before. And he'd also told Camille he'd only been married once before, not three times.
What a rotter.
He's a sick bastard. We'll get to it. Over the next 4 years, Samuel continued to live at the farm and became part of the local community, attending church and giving generously to local causes such as the enlargement of the churchyard and the interior redecoration of the church.
See, when I hear that, I immediately think they're doing this because of some dark thing they've got. A lot of the time you hear people putting extra money into the church because they want to make themselves feel better for things.
Mm. You would be spot on the money.
Hey.
Dougal's social life also blossomed. Local gossip spoke of a rural playboy mansion where a long string of female servants came and went. Those who accepted Dougal's request for extracurricular services stayed a bit longer. And before long, Dougal was in court being sued for child support by multiple women. There was also a rumour that Dougal was fond of having naked women bicycle through the grounds of the estate, which the townspeople seemed to have treated as an eccentric but troubling quirk. However, the new slash old Mrs. Dougal didn't seem to find it all that quirky, and she finally ran away with one of the farm labourers. After 4 years, people did start to wonder how it was that Samuel, who had no visible means of support, could afford to be so generous to the community and to his various women friends and live in such a grand style. It was Camille's nephew who finally raised the red flag in March 1903, when he was shown some checks supposedly written by his aunt and immediately realised it was not her handwriting. Dougal was finally charged with forging, and I don't know why they call it this, uttering a cheque to the value of £28.15, payable to Jay Heath, dated the 28th of August 1902. And the cheque was apparently drawn by Camille at Clavering. During the trial, which began in the spring of 1903, the prosecution produced evidence to show that Samuel had systematically moved money from Camille's accounts into his own, sold her stocks and shares, and even transferred the title of Moat Farm to his name. This trial, 4 years after the disappearance of Camille, triggered an interest in her whereabouts. Who goes yachting for 4 years, for goodness sake, and everybody just completely forgets? The police took possession of Moat Farm, crowds of spectators, mainly women, gathered to watch the police raid the home. Oranges and nuts were sold to the crowds as they waited for the discovery to be made. They also sold commemorative postcards. And there's still quite a few of these hanging about. I found some and I'm going to put them on Instagram when we post the story.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's
they didn't have TV.
Is it who was it who which was the serial killer who had all those female fans? Was it Ted Bundy or was
Ted
it
Ted Bundy, yeah.
Yeah. This guy is full Ted Bundy.
Oh God.
So 2 weeks after they took possession, apparently with the aid of Camille's little dog, Jacko, which had been taken in by one of her friends in the village, Mrs. Wiskins, Camille's body was found in a drainage ditch. She was identified by the custom size 2 shoes that she was wearing and some items of jewellery, including the ring from her first love, a naval officer who had drowned many years back. The ring had been taken from his body and given to her. The cause of death was a shot to the head.
Thinking heck.
Dougal was eventually hanged for his crimes. Interestingly, there are some records that Samuel Dougal applied for the post of executioner in about 1899 to 1900, but was passed over when the list of competent persons was put together in January 1890. The reason being was that he had been tried but not sentenced for arson in previous years. And if you want to learn more about his treachery, because it's much worse than I've described here, he's got multiple wives, multiple women he's had children by. He's been done for forgery several times before he's even met Camille. I really suggest going to the Essex Police Museum website and reading all about it. Also, this is gross, but when he was in prison, he seems to have stayed in contact with the various women he was seeing and had children by, and even organised for them to come and watch the trial, suggesting to his lawyer that they rent a little trap for them all to come down on and that it would be a grand day out for them all.
What?
Very much Ted Bundy vibes.
Oh, it's just weird.
Yeah, it's gross. Now, it was only a few years after the trial when a local blacksmith who was passing by the now abandoned Moat Farm reported piano music coming from the deserted building. Camille, in her life before Samuel, had been a piano teacher, and the blacksmith swore it sounded exactly like her playing. It became part of local folklore in the area that Camille's ghost would crawl out of the ditch where her body had been dumped at night to go back to the house and play piano. Much of the poltergeist activity was also attributed to her spirit, and I get it. I'd throw stuff if that was me too.
Yeah.
But there is one strange thing that Dougal related to a reporter before he was hung. After he killed Camille, he returned to the home and drank a glass of brandy. When he finished, he got up and left the house, intending to go back to the body and bury it. However, he couldn't bring himself to do it yet. He tried several times to go back out. So he was going in and out of the front door over and over and over again. So the opening and the closing of the front door may have been down to Dougal's ghost reenacting the night he murdered Camille. And if you're interested in what happened to Camille's little dog, Jacko, well, it was taken in by Mrs. Wiskins, where he lived as a pampered pet and a source of much fascination right up until his death, when he was promptly stuffed and kept in a glass case. Today, you can visit him at the Essex Police Museum as part of their exhibition on the Moat Farm murder.
Oh, that's awesome. I want to see Jacko.
I'll post a picture on Instagram. He's very cute. And there are some pictures of him alive posing with the police officers as well.
Oh, we have to go.
I loved that. I really wanted to tell that story because it sounds like something from a novel.
It reminded me a little bit of The Haunting of Bly House or Bly Manor, where she would go back into from the lake.
Yeah. Yeah. This was, except this one, she doesn't get a lake. She gets a drainage ditch.
Yeah. God, no, it's left horrendous, isn't it? It's horrible.
Yeah, he's a bad, bad man.
That's a bad man. Oh, what's at Moat Farm now? Is it still a farmhouse?
Well, this is the thing. I've been trying to find it on the map. So it was previously known as Coldham's Farm. So I also tried looking for Coldham Farm. And it's really hard to pinpoint. I was trying for several hours to try and drop a needle on it.
Yeah.
But you can't find it on Google Maps, but you can find it on maps with listings for historical buildings. So right. I was trying to look at the map and then transfer it over to the Google map, but it's that nothing was matching up. It was really irritating. Possibly I'll find it after this episode and I'll keep hacking away at it.
Right.
Yeah. So, Bethan, what's your first one?
Mine is The Ghosts of Wilson House. Actually, all of my stories today come from the amazing Wesley H. Down books. He's done several of these books. It's part of the Wesley's Essex collection. And this particular one is from Haunted Clacton. And they're just so... It's nice that you can hear Wesley's voice in them.
Yeah, he does have a very distinctive style, doesn't he?
He does, bless him.
My previous one, the Poltergeist Activity portion of it came from Betty Puttock, who we know that the lawmen love the name of. So
they can't get enough of Puttock, can they?
Yeah, they do love a bit of Puttock.
Well, mine, as I said, is The Ghosts of Wilson House. Until a few years ago, there was a girls' private day and boarding school in Lees Road, Clacton, known as St. Monica's School. As the number of boarding pupils increased, it became necessary to obtain extra accommodation, so the nearby ancient farmhouse known as Alton Park was purchased and renamed Wilson House. Dating back before even 1086, Alton Park was recorded in the Domesday Book, and over the years has played its part in local history and continued to do so until 1953, when, as stated above, the property was sold to St. Monica's School and renamed Wilson House after Bishop Henry Wilson. It was at this period of time that various stories of hauntings began to circulate. It is widely believed that some psychic force is either given off or taken from young girls of this age, he writes. So it's not really surprising that there should have been manifestations occurring when there are several girls of this age together in an old building which has already seen its share of trouble over the years. To mention all the alleged goings on would no doubt fill a book of its own. To get some idea of what the girls saw and heard, it's very nicely summed up in the following poem, composed with the help of some of the past residents of Wilson House.
I was just about to say, it sounds very much like Peeves the Poltergeist, doesn't it?
It does a bit, yes. And when you said all the stories would fill a book of its own, it's like, oh, is he going to tell us? No.
No. They never do.
I know. But if anybody listening used to or knows anybody that went to Wilson House and knows some of these stories, please contact us because I'm desperate to know what went on. And I'm sure Wesley's collection of stories would have them in it. And I know his son has taken over. So I was going to say hunt his son down, but that sounded quite ominous. So try and contact his son about it. But here we go. Here is the poem.
Please don't be afraid of us, Wesley's son.
Yeah, please don't be afraid. We're nice. So here's a poem of The Ghosts of Wilson's House. So many nights we've lain awake and heard the beams and floorboards shake and listened to the moans and groans of ghosts and grinding bones. There is no peace in West 8 dorm, especially when the night is warm. For through the window in the night appears a lady dressed in white. And hobnail boots above is heard when all the rats and bats are stirred. Or if in north you've ever slept and from your bed you've softly crept to see beyond the open door, William pace the corridor. On Halloween, when night is young, on the large meat hook the butler's hung, and you'll hear his cries borne through the air. It's enough to raise a prefect's hair. Once William killed his master's wife with sharp and cruel and bloody knife. He killed the lady dressed in white at Halloween about midnight, when hobnail boots his neck had wrung, across the hook his body slung, in anger at his cruel deed, yet from the sin he's ne'er been freed. But oh, to be in Wilson, so many girls have cried, yet maybe they would change their minds if ever they had tried, with clanking chains and grinding bones and footsteps in the night, and moans and groans and wailings when you've turned out the lights.
Wow. So was that story about William killing the master's wife, was that based on fact?
I'm going to look more into this. I think a trip to Chelmsford record office might be in order. Because I couldn't find anything in the usual places. So
it's
a to be continued, this one.
It seems to be a feature of some of these stories that there is like a pseudo history around them. I've got a story later that's very similar to your one, with a few distinct differences where there is a story of something bad happening in the past, but I can't find any evidence that actually took place.
Right. Yeah, we get that a lot with these stories, don't we? Well, just to end on, Wilson House in Alton Park was demolished in the 1970s, but a new house has been erected on the site. So I wonder if things continue in the new place.
Oh, like that. What was it called? The Christmas Ghost Stories. Do you remember the one that had, I think it was Mark Gatiss was probably involved because he always is. They're on that new housing estate and he finds the door knocker.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was good, wasn't it? But it was all to do with the house that was there before. But it was happening in his house, which was like a new built home.
I know the one you mean. It was a several, it was like a several parter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there was, it's on Amazon Prime. Type in Mark Gatiss, you'll find it.
And you'll probably find a whole bunch of other scary things.
Yes. Some good, some not so good, I found on Amazon Prime. Okay, that's my first story.
I particularly like Mark Gatiss's History of Horror documentary he did a while back. I found that really good.
Yes, I really liked his folk horror one.
Yeah. Shall I charge ahead with this next story?
Go for it.
I'm going to give a bit of a warning first. This one is a bit gory. It does have significance to events that have happened recently. There's been a few people who have, in the heat, been trying to cool off around Clacton, and unfortunately they drowned. So this story does have elements of that, and I'll try and be as sensitive as possible, but if that's something that's affecting you right now, maybe give this one a little skip over. This strange case took place in Clacton in 1986. This case, again, comes from Wesley Downs, who interviewed the people directly involved but agreed to keep their details private because there was police action involved.
Oh, right.
A local man had taken his dog for a walk on the beach that evening but had returned without his dog. It was fairly common for the dog to run off and return by himself, so he wasn't worried. Hours later, the dog returns, and it's just before the stroke of midnight, and he can hear the scratching at the door. He goes to open the door and let the pup in. However, the dog's brought a little present home with him, a full human arm. Nice. Now, what would you do if your dog dragged in a human arm with him?
I have no idea.
I'd have probably screamed the house down and called the police immediately.
Yes.
But maybe people are just built different in Clacton, because this guy carefully wraps the arm up in a plastic bag and puts it in a freezer next to the frozen peas and fish fingers before he goes back to bed. Exactly.
That's different. That's a different way of handling it.
Can you guess what happens next?
He accidentally cooks it with the peas.
Oh, no, that would have been so horrible. So the man and his wife, only a few minutes later, having gone to bed, are awoken by the strange sound of rapping, as though someone was tap, tap, tapping somewhere in the house.
You rhymed that then. Well done.
It was on purpose. This was followed by some unusually loud moans and groans. I'm guessing they didn't share any walls with their neighbours, because my first thought wouldn't have been a poltergeist. Yeah. It would have been somebody having a good time. The man got out of bed and decided to go downstairs to investigate, but the noises ceased immediately when he got onto the stairs. So he went back up, and no sooner had he got back into bed, the sound started once again. The next day, the man took the arm to the police station, and I can't even imagine the poor desk sergeant's face when he pulled that out of the bag. The man was then interviewed at length by the police about the arm and his connection to it before he was allowed to return home. Wesley says he confirmed this with the local police, but because he went to confirm it, he was then questioned thoroughly himself, because he had an interest in the case and the arm. So they obviously were quite concerned about where this arm had come from.
Yeah.
That night, when the man returned from the police station, the rapping and the moaning started up all over again, but this time even louder. This continued for weeks, disturbing their lives, causing them to be sleep deprived, until suddenly stopping for months. At this time, the man's wife and his children went to go visit relatives and have a break from the house. And in the meantime, the man stayed behind to install a long-promised central heating system. The very first night that his family were away, the man, in his own words, says, "All hell broke loose."
Ooh.
The tapping had increased in volume to full-blown banging, and moans and groans were louder than ever before. The man jumped out of bed with the niggling feeling that perhaps this time it could be burglars trying to get in, since they thought that family was away. So he ran through the house with a length of timber, screaming his lungs off for whoever it was to get out. But of course, he found no one. It took him a while to calm down, but when he did, in typical British fashion, with all the hullabaloo still carrying on about him, he made himself
a cup of tea.
A cup of tea.
Yes.
And sat down to have a little chat with his poltergeist. He explained he no longer had the arm and that the ghost did not belong there anymore. Then he calmly clicked off the light and went to bed. This approach seems to have worked, since the next few nights the noises decreased in volume and eventually disappeared. So.
That is so British.
I know. He just had a nice little chat, didn't he, with a cup of tea.
Cup of tea. Set the world to right.
This is where, if you've lost somebody to in Clacton recently, I'd probably stop listening.
What was that behind you then?
Behind me?
Yeah.
What? I didn't see anything.
Well, there was a bang and I saw something behind you.
What? No. Oh my God, you're scaring me. Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. Didn't you hear that?
Where was it? No, I didn't hear anything. What was it behind me? Where's Cass?
The other way.
Cass is asleep on the bed.
Right. I'm staying over your house tomorrow night. I don't want to see this.
Well, nothing's... Oh, no, something did happen before, but I... Who knows?
Carry on the story.
Okay. So, this wasn't necessarily the limb of someone who had been murdered and chopped up and thrown into the sea. My search history took a bit of a turn for the morbid this week, as I remembered something about feet regularly washing up on the Pacific Northwest. So that area of America.
Oh, God, yes.
So it turns out in the water, human bodies naturally disarticulate or come apart at the joints. So hands and feet often disconnect from the corpses after soaking up in the ocean for a while. So this may have been a victim of drowning or even suicide.
Oh, dear.
Though I've got to say, this did remind me of another story that I haven't been able to share before because it's not necessarily supernatural. It was in the Grim Almanac of Essex. And it's quite gory, but it kind of amused me a little bit, I'm afraid to say.
What?
In 1925, there was a motorcyclist traveling through Stanford Rivers. He was a mechanic from Ongar, and he ran over something, and then he stopped to see what he'd run over. And it turned out it was a full woman's leg, complete with laced boot and stocking.
Oh.
The motorcyclist did a search of the area for the rest of the woman, but didn't find any more body parts. So the limb was handed over to the police. This was reported in the Weekly Dispatch, and the police gave the comment that so far no one had come forward to claim it. That was the part that amused me.
My leg. That's where it got to.
It's like, oh, I'm wondering where I put that down.
Oh, these poor desk sergeants.
Oh,
getting limbs handed to...
I mean, when I worked for Colchester and Ipswich Museum Service, when I worked in natural history, sometimes people would come in and just go, "I found this." And they give you like a Tesco's plastic shopping bag and you'd unwrap it and it'd be like a full flipping femur.
Jeepers.
and you just go, "I'm pretty sure it's a cow, but thank you."
Thank you for that. Well, didn't in Roehead, not long ago actually, a skeleton was found, and it was actually someone from the village who kept to herself.
Oh no.
But some people didn't really think much that they hadn't seen her for a while, but to actually become a skeleton
is a long time. So sad.
So sad. I can't remember when that was. It wasn't recently, in the last 100 years.
Oh gosh, that's horrible.
Really horrible.
But I do like that the dog brought the arm home and then it immediately stopped banging.
Like, yeah.
Let me out of this freezer.
Well, I assume kicking. Oh, no, it's an arm. Yeah,
no, it was, yeah, the leg was the motorcyclist no longer, and so we have no evidence that he was kicked at all afterwards.
Oh,
um, Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, especially I made the point of saying that he was installing a central heating system, because usually when you get bangs and taps, people will attribute that to the pipes.
Yeah.
And this house obviously didn't have a central heating system until this guy started to install it. And it was on the first night, before he'd even really done anything, that it got
really attributed
out of control. Yeah.
Interesting.
So that interested me a lot. But again, I trust Wesley when he says he was taken by the police to ask why he was interested in this random arm. But I can't find any news reports around it.
And if anybody's been wondering about Elsa's internet search history lately, it has been for the podcast.
Yes, please don't think
I'm planning anything.
I just want to know why these limbs keep appearing.
That was a good story. And yeah, there's a picture, isn't there, to go with the...
You've got a very sweet illustration of the dog and his little arm that you're going to send me, aren't you?
Yeah, I've taken a picture of it. I'll put it on Instagram. It's strangely sweet, considering the subject matter.
I just love that the dog was like, I got you a present. And that poor man was probably like, I don't know, I can't ever let this dog lick me again. Like,
does every story today have a dog in it?
The first two didn't, did they? No, they didn't. Oh no, Jacko. Yeah,
Jacko.
Sorry, I forgot Jacko. No, not every
didn't.
Single. Yeah, not every single story I have has a dog in it.
Well, as long as you like, you know, say very early on if the dog is okay, because that's when I watch a film and there's a dog, the first thing I Google is the dog.
Does the dog die? There's a website that tells you, does the dog die?
Does the dog die? Right. I've got one for Wesley again. This is from Wesley's Essex collection, The Haunted Colchester Area, which is, I think you've got as well, haven't you? The blue one?
Yes, I have the blue one. Amassing quite a collection of these.
I've got all of them. I've got one for you, actually. I've got the spare Bawley.
Oh, yes, please. I would like that.
I'll bring it over tomorrow night.
Thank you.
There is a house in Abbots Road, Colchester, that was built before the turn of the century at the site of a former rectory. So far as can be ascertained, there's no logical reason for the present building to be haunted, but as in the best traditions, houses have been built on sites of old rectories should be haunted. So why break with the tradition? I love his turn of phrase. The present occupiers have lived there for a number of years, but during the last 8 or so years, now when this was written was, so when he's saying like in the last 8 or so years, he wrote this in 1992, which to me doesn't seem that long ago, but it was, you know.
It was over 20 years ago.
So this was happening about 28 years ago. Various things have happened. It makes them believe that the place is also occupied by the spirit of a young girl who at times makes her presence felt in many ways. Items are often moved from one place to another, sometimes even disappearing for days and then reappearing, either in the place from where they were removed or an entirely different location. One Christmas, a large bow was purchased to be put on the Christmas tree, but it strangely disappeared only to reappear some days later in the bathroom. That same Christmas, some parcels placed under the Christmas tree disappeared but were later found in the upstairs bedroom. On another occasion, a room mysteriously filled with smoke for no apparent reason. It hung about for some time and then disappeared as quickly as it appeared.
Mm.
There was a time when an air freshener flew from the downstairs toilet across the passage into the kitchen. It did not hit anyone, but there was a near miss before it gently fell to the floor.
Oh, weird. I wonder what kind of air freshener it was.
Of all the things, you're wondering what brand.
Well, no, I was just wondering like how heavy it was. Like...
Oh, right. Ooh, which one is that? Glade. I don't know. Another time, the lady's sister had been staying in the house for a few days with their 2-year-old daughter. Just before they were about to leave and were standing in the kitchen, a film cassette was thrown from where it was placed on the windowsill across the room at head height, just missing the sister to crash to the floor. It was thought that this was done to show the spirit's annoyance at the little girl leaving. Oh, she liked the little girl. The reason that it is thought the spirit is that of a young girl is perhaps it's always brightly coloured things that are moved or played with. One time when their 17-year-old son was in a room, the bookcase doors opened and a book fell, landing on the floor open at a page where there was a poem they had been discussing only a few days earlier.
Oh, interesting. But my brain goes there, like if they'd been discussing that poem, they might have opened the book and then therefore the book would be cracked and that would make it, yeah.
But still.
It's still, cool. Yeah, it's still cool, yeah.
Strange footsteps have been heard in various parts of the house, but when the house had been searched, nothing or nobody that could have caused them could be found. And although most of the happenings could easily be described as mischievous, there was one time it is thought the spirit world saved them a great loss. The house had been burgled, drawers ransacked, and valuable items stolen. In one of the drawers there had been a small cardboard box that contained a gold chain. The box had been broken open and the contents removed, presumed stolen. A few days later, when the drawer was opened, the lady was surprised to find the box restored to almost its former condition, and the gold chain was inside it. Yet the police had seen the box in its damaged condition, and there was definitely no chain to be seen anywhere. Had the spirit been aware of what was about to happen and decided to remove the chain first? These are mysteries that may never be solved, but in the meantime, certainly give food for thought. Do you know where my mind originally went to this?
Where? Because my mind just went somewhere as well.
I went brownie.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than a ghost.
I was thinking, it kind of reminded me of Patty's story from Uncanny, where the incidents kept on happening, but then eventually it kind of saved her and her friend from something much worse happening.
Yeah, definitely. It sort of like was on their side.
Yeah, in a kind of destructive and horrible way, but...
Oh, yeah, Patty's is much more malevolent.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Patty, if you're listening.
Hi, Patty.
We miss you.
Hope the alpacas are okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it didn't, I mean, if you were to tell me the story but not have said there's a poltergeist or a ghost involved, possibly because of our last episode and all the, you know, we've been sort of like going down the rabbit hole of the fae folk and I've been
all the things
haunted.
That happened to you as well.
Yeah, exactly. And my potatoes,
which
have yet
potatoes.
To be returned.
You're going to find some green mulch somewhere and it's going to be horrific.
No, it definitely took them back to the Fae Realm. So okay. The Fae Realm were enjoying some nice organic Tesco's finest. as someone was asking what's happening lately, the last time I had something thrown at my head was when I came home one evening and I opened the front door and something whacked me in the forehead. A stone was thrown at me.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
And it couldn't have fallen off the roof because I'd actually gone inside the porch bit. And that's the last thing that's happened. So I don't know if I've done something to placate it. I'm really scared at the moment because the hawthorn bush has been taken up.
Uh-oh.
We've got a lovely guy that comes to do our garden because I'm knackered and Jack's got a bad back. So we asked this guy to come and he's really good, bless him. I forgot to say don't dig up the hawthorn.
Oh, no.
They dug it up. So I'm waiting for the wave of wrath that comes with.
Maybe they'll go after him.
Oh, bless. I hope not. I have to warn him. No, I sound completely nuts then. But with like things, is it called apports? Like things disappearing and appearing. Mm. You hear them a lot with poltergeist cases. Like I think that's how the Battersea poltergeist started. There was a necklace or a locket. That
there was a key, wasn't there?
A key,
appeared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Appeared, which seems to be go hand in hand, but also you hear of things disappearing and reappearing with anything
poltergeist,
to do with,
yeah,
well, or fae or brownies, because it sounds more mischievous to me than malevolent.
Well, my next case does a little bit of that, but then it does get very malevolent.
Okay, go for it.
So there are two cases I looked at for this next story. And I debated on this lovely one called the Wivenhoe Poltergeist that I found on the internet, which is a first-hand account from somebody that this happened to. However, it's so well written and it's such a lovely story. I did contact her because I would have loved to have gotten her on the podcast, but I haven't heard anything back. I don't want to read it out for you because I don't want to ruin it. It's too well done to start with. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the details at the end so you can look it up for yourselves.
Yeah, I know the one. It's a good one.
It's very Liz Sauer, I thought.
Yes, very Liz Sauer.
The way it's written. I would have loved for her to have told it on the podcast. But what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to give you a story from Wesley Downs about three little old ladies and a poltergeist.
That sounds like a really good film I'd watch.
Yeah, I love this story. So these sweet old ladies were the golden girls of poltergeist activity. They were three old friends who later in life decided to pull their resources and move in together. Only a few weeks after moving in did they sense something was not quite right. Objects were being moved around their rooms, personal items would disappear and reappear weeks later. clumping, they also, and this relates back to your story from the Wilson House, clumping footfalls could be heard during the night, which were keeping them up. And they described it as though somebody was stomping about wearing hobnailed boots.
Oh.
The ladies felt as though someone had a personal vendetta against them. One of them even found that the end of their bed was lifted clean off the floor while she was awake, having been kept up by the stomping of the boots going around her room.
Oh.
Finally, it all seemed to come to a head when the spirit manifested in a blazing ball of white fire and floated towards one of them, leaving them with a numbing chill. Wesley Downs, recording the story in his memoirs of an Essex ghost hunter, in this postscript, he notes that the research turned up a suicide that had taken place in this house. This house was in the Hornbeams in Harlow, by the way. And oh, I did go and look for, this is the one where I said I looked for evidence of this, and I wasn't sure I could find it. But a man who had previously lived in this building before it had been renovated had been jilted by his lover at the altar, and he grew to hate all women before taking his own life years later.
Crumbs.
So this all turned out to be a bit too much for the three sweet old ladies, and a priest was brought in to exorcise the spirit, and much to the three women's relief and eternal gratitude, they were left in peace afterwards. But in my extra research, I did realise that this case took place in 1977, the same year that the Enfield case began. And when I looked on the map, Enfield is only 30 minutes down the road from the Hornbeams in Harlow.
Ooh.
And then when I looked up, when did the movie The Poltergeist come out? It was 1985. So it's obviously not influencing.
1977 was a good year because you had the Broadhaven UFO as well in
Wales. Oh, right. Something happened in 1977 that's probably screwed everyone.
1977 seemed to be good years for stuff.
So if you'd like to read The Wivenhoe Poltergeist, you can find it on essexandsuffolksurnames.co.uk, which is a blog about genealogy and heritage. But she just happened to include this personal story of hers a few years back. And it was written by a woman called Helen Barrell. So Helen, if you're listening, if you're listening to this, we'd love to talk to you. And you're a brilliant writer. And we very much enjoyed your story about the Wivenhoe Poltergeist. And we'd love to talk to you. And Bethan's in Wivenhoe. So, you know, if you see somebody wandering around with blue hair, yell Bethan. And she'll come running right over.
Yeah, I probably will. Oh, I'm going to reread that story myself, actually.
It's one. Great. And the blog itself is really interesting. I read a few more other articles because it popped up every now and again. There was, whilst I was doing research, another case which I failed to find any more information on, but I got really excited over it because Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually advised on the case and instructed the priest on giving the special rites to get rid of the poltergeist.
He instructed the priest?
Apparently. And this appears in a magazine called The Truth in April 1922.
I did see it in the archive.
Yeah. But then when I go back, I can't find anything more in that magazine, but specifically anywhere else. Though through searching that, I did find that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was well known for giving advice on poltergeist cases.
Really? I didn't know that. I knew he was interested in the spiritual realm.
There was quite a horrific one up north, I think, that he got involved in as well.
Mm.
But yes, he apparently did investigate. He was a ghost hunter as well.
Legend.
Yeah.
I have one more.
Go for it.
And this is from Wesley. He is the hero of this episode.
It's a very Wesley episode.
It is. And this is from my favourite one of his, The Terrible Treasure Hunt Story, which we did speak about in the monk episode, but it came with lots of other stories after the main event. So half the book is Treasure Hunt, and then the rest of it is stories from the surrounding area. So this is about a bungalow at Plough Corner in Little Clacton. Now, this bungalow is said to have been built over a point where two ley lines cross. I know. The bungalow was built in 1961, possibly on the site of a much earlier building. I'm going to go and do some digging into this. I like looking at my maps. So I will update on that. The point where the ley lines cross is thought to be an area of great magnetic energy, and this force is believed to have various magical powers. Sick animals have been known to seek out such spots, lie down on them, later to stand up, apparently fully recovered.
Ooh, that's interesting.
I didn't know that. It's also thought that these crossing points are areas of great psychic energy, which often enable manifestations to take place. This could account for a pair of phantom hands that have been seen floating across one of the rooms in the bungalow. Perhaps it is the magnetic energy from these ley lines that causes the temperature to suddenly drop, cause the lights to flicker, make the television picture tremble, then fade away, cause the electric switches to switch themselves on and off, or it could just be some playful spirit testing out the energy it has just picked up. Legend has it that a gibbet once stood on the side of the building and a man was hanged on it in the 17th century.
Yee.
So yeah, this is a lovely place to build your bungalow. This could possibly account for the ghost of a highwayman or robber seen appearing about the house, either as a complete misty figure or just a pair of hands. The full figure was last seen in about 1985-86. Sometimes voices can be heard throughout the house. Doors open and close of their own volition. Often three knocks occur.
Oh yeah, that's very significant, isn't it?
Very.
Three knocks at a time, because it's meant to be a aberration against the Holy Trinity. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's the atheist.
There's the atheist, yes. Where had I got up to? So often three knocks occur before the kitchen doors open of their own accord, and sometimes the television will switch itself on and off. There is a regular ghost who visits the occupants, and they call it Derek. And they always know when he is about or has been seen, because knives go missing from the drawer. Sometimes they fly through the air to stick to the kitchen door.
Oh, no.
Other times they turn up in odd places, sometimes days later. The occupiers believe they know who Derek was. They think it was a friend who took his own life in Holland Marshes some years ago by stabbing himself in the heart. He always appears at 6:30 p.m. on the 26th of February, the anniversary of his death.
Gosh.
Yeah. So that, I'm going to look more into that house.
Where was it again?
Little Clacton. Oh, little there's Clacton. A picture.
Oh, yeah. The lovely little dog with his gross little arm. What I find interesting is that we have always thought of poltergeists as being very attached to young people.
Mm.
But a lot of these stories that we've gone through today haven't been
typical.
And then
perhaps the only one, really, the Wilson House.
Yes, the Wilson House one is the only one that I'd say was completely typical of a poltergeist.
This is Plough Corner at Little Clacton.
Oh, yeah. Remember you telling me that. Mm. So I did find this really interesting book called Haunted People by somebody last name Carrington. It was published in the 1950s, I think 1953. And its first few chapters, its first chapter, The March of the Poltergeist, is a look through time at different poltergeist cases.
Oh, interesting. And
annoyingly, they don't once cover one in Essex, even though we definitely know they're there.
Well, Bawley.
Yeah, well, no, it's that's the only one they do mention, actually, is Bawley.
Of course it is. Sorry, we will cover Bawley. I just, personally, I don't see the, apart from Harry Price being involved, I don't understand the hoo-ha about it.
Yeah, it's more interesting as like a social commentary than it is.
Langenhoe Church had far more.
Mm. And also, if you listen to a podcast called Dark Histories, that's my recommendation for the month. They do a really good episode on Bawley. So I recommend listening to that. Anyway, this book by Carrington, it goes through a lot of poltergeist activity from the year 355 AD
wow.
to obviously up to the book being published. And there's a lot of similar features like rains of stones and things being moved. Also, fires setting themselves, which we didn't find one of those, but I'm probably sure.
Did.
The everything one you read out?
Everything you've just said has happened in the paranormal intruder story.
Oh, of course, yes. The one that you were saving.
Yeah, I was going to cover a story by Caroline Mitchell, which is a really amazing account of a poltergeist activity her and her family were subjected to. But it wasn't something I could just slip in as a small story. Me and Elsa have decided Elsa's going to go away and read it.
I'm excited.
And then we need a whole episode on it because it's the phenomena is phenomenal. It's incredible.
It's phenomenal phenomena.
Phenomenal phenomena. I literally am reading the book with my jaw on the floor. I think I've told the uncanny community to get on it. I think Michelle's reading it right now.
So all the way from 355 AD to up to the 1950s, you get these very similar cases happening again and again and again. Some of them involve young people and some of them don't. But they all have like this very similar line of these certain activities happening, which I just found amazing because they're going from like biblical stories to newspaper reports in the 1950s, and it stays the same.
Yeah.
But they also cover lots of different background. Well, what am I saying? Lots of different countries' versions of it, and. Something I sent you, which I found really interesting, was this report on jinn and how one case of poltergeist activity, a Muslim man was brought into the house at one point and he immediately said, oh, this is a jinn.
Yeah.
And this is how you're going to get rid of it.
I find jinn fascinating.
Yeah. And then there's a few mentions in this March of the Poltergeist chapter about how some of these cases happening in Islamic countries were attributed to jinn as well. So it's interesting how different communities view it. I mean, and then we were talking about brownies, about how similar it is to them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's it's almost like there's mischievous and malevolent.
Yeah. Though it, you know, sometimes builds to malevolence. I don't really want to see a ball of white fire floating towards me.
Or kitchen knives flying across the room.
No. Why would your friend throw kitchen knives at you from beyond the grave?
Yeah, I did wonder that. But yeah, we will get to the big story.
Yeah. There's another story I was going to cover as well, but again, much too big. It needs its own episode, or possibly it needs to be included in a wider subject, which was Scrapfagot Green.
Scrapfagot Green, yeah, I can imagine that would fit nicely in with the stones.
Yeah,
what we're gonna do, or as you say, might need its own because a lot happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the most amazing name in the world.
Yeah, it's so the word scrapfagot actually means witch in Old English.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything that is
in Old English and Irish. Yeah, doesn't mean what it means in like the States.
Yes, of course.
It's not a derogatory term.
Derogatory, that was the word I was trying to find. It's not, in this case, it is not a derogatory term for somebody from the LGBTQIA community. It's derogatory towards witches.
And it's also a rather nice meatball in Wales.
Yeah.
And a lazy person in Ireland.
Oh, and a clump of grass in Scotland.
And kindling.
Yes.
So there you go, a bit of etymology. Just thrown in for free. Can I recommend a podcast?
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to recommend Owen Staton and his Time Between Times. If you like your folklore in a immersive storytelling way, it's fab. He is so good at, he's got the right voice for it. Imagine Richard Burton telling you folk tales. It's very
good. Sounds lovely.
I'm working with him at the moment on a joint one about Glamorgan, where I'm from. Well, we're both from. So we'll let you know what's going on with that. But yeah, that's my recommendation. It's fab. And at 9 p.m. most nights, he does a live telling. And what is incredible is it's off the top of his head.
Wow.
He knows the stories and he tells them, but it's like an amazing like Dylan Thomas script.
That's incredible. I mean, it just took me 2 minutes to remember the word derogatory.
I think, you know, it's early.
It's not that early. Is it?
There's no excuse then, Ailsa.
No, it's just the leftover brain fog from the COVID.
Oh, bless you. Yeah, that's another reason why you didn't have anything last month. Ailsa finally succumbed.
Oh, after so many years, finally got the COVID. I was actually had COVID whilst recording the last episode. That's why it sounded like
death.
Rubbish.
And then you tested positive the next day, didn't you?
Yeah, the very next day I woke up with two tonsils the size of tennis balls and I was positive for COVID.
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a month, hasn't it?
Been
a mare of a month.
It's been a mare, complete and utter mare. But we're back, better than ever. We also, whilst we were away for the month, worked on our project, which is coming along nicely.
Yes, we've got some locations plans, and we're going to be announcing those soon. We should be going soon, actually, because we need to beautify ourselves because we're having a photo shoot tonight for our new website.
Yes.
Very excited about.
That doesn't scare me more than ghosts.
Yeah, I know. You'll be fine.
I forgot. But what on earth did you see behind me?
Well as recording the audio, I'm recording the video, so I can look back.
Was it like a shadow or was it?
It was like movement.
Oh, that's so strange.
It was like someone walked behind you.
What, horizontal or?
In the doorway, where you had the thing fly off the wall.
Oh my God.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we'll bid you adieu. As ever, if you know anything about any of the stories we've spoken about today, especially as a lot of it was left to a bit of mystery, until we can track down Wesley's son, again, not ominous. If you could fill in the gaps.
We promise we'd mean you no harm. We just want stories.
Yeah, we just want stories. If anyone can fill in the gaps, that'd be great. If anybody's living in the houses currently, sorry if we're giving you nightmares.
Yeah, especially with Moat Farm. I'm really sorry about that.
But yeah, look forward to hearing from you. So it's goodbye from Elsa.
And it's goodbye from Bethan.
Bye. If you'd like to get in contact with us with a story of your own or any more information about what we've discussed in this episode, you can reach us at eerieessexpodcast@gmail.com.
Or if you'd like to contact us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram under the handle eerieessex. On Twitter, we are under eerie_essex. You can also find us on Patreon and Ko-fi if you'd like to support the podcast.